This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of January 22nd, here are a few top stories. In the news, cities around Arizona are asking for changes to a recent law that has put them in conflict with the Attorney General. The show's Mark Brody has more on the story.
The Arizona Attorney General has been asked to investigate cities around the state, from Tucson to Bisbee to Tempe, under a 2016 law that allows the state to withhold money from cities found to have ordinances that violate state law. Senate Bill 1487 has allowed lawmakers to ask the AG to look into issues ranging from tax breaks to gun laws to bans on plastic bags. Now cities are asking state legislators to change some of the provisions of that law. And joining me to talk about those changes is Ken Strobeck, Executive Director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. Ken, good morning. Thanks for being here.
You bet. Thank you, Mark.
So one of the big changes, it seems, you would like to limit somewhat who is able to ask the AG to investigate, more based on a geographical representation.
Yes. Actually, starting at the beginning, what we would really like is to have this entire law repealed. We think it's way overdone, heavy-handed, and really punitive to cities and towns who want to make their own decisions about certain matters. And one legislator can basically overrule an entire community, a city council, and we don't think that's fair. But there aren't the votes in the legislature for a full repeal, unfortunately. So we are drafting legislation that would make some changes, and that's the most important one, the one you just mentioned. There have been so far 8 complaints filed under Senate Bill 1487. All but one of those complaints have been filed by legislators that are far distant, hundreds of miles in some cases, from the community that they're complaining about. And basically what we're seeing is that special interest groups bring these issues forward, give them to a friendly legislator who then attacks a city somewhere far away in another part of the state, and there's no accountability whatsoever. Let's say that the voters in that community or that that district don't like the actions of that legislator. They have no recourse. They can't say we will vote against you or we will vote for you or whatever because they're hundreds of miles away.
So you would like it so that a legislator has to represent at least part of the city that they are complaining against?
Yes, exactly. We just think that's a fair accountability measure to put in place to say, hey, if you're going to make an action that could essentially bankrupt a community, you should at least be able to answer for that and stand up for your actions with the voters in that city.
What are some of the other significant changes you would like to see?
Well, another one is to have equal access for the city to the court system. The way this bill was drafted is these Arizona Attorney General makes a determination unilaterally all by himself and says you're either violation or not violation or may violate. And if it's one of those categories such as may violate, the Attorney General can take action straight to the Supreme Court. If he says it does violate, then the city has no ability to go to the Supreme Court. If we wanted to even fight it at all, we would have to start at Superior Court and go all the way through the Court of Appeals to get back to the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, the law requires that a city would have to put up a bond equal to 6 months of their shared revenue. Well, that's impossible for any city to do, regardless of the community, just because of the scale. Shared revenue is approximately 40% of a city's general operating budget. And to say that you have to put up 6 months of a bond is absolutely unattainable by anyone. So we basically have no access to the court. So we'd like to have at least the same access to the Supreme Court that the Attorney General has.
You mentioned that there are not the votes in the legislature to repeal this law. Do you think you have the votes to make these changes?
You know, I think we probably do. You know, we haven't done a hard vote count yet because we don't have the bill yet introduced. We do have a sponsor. Senator Kate Brophy McGee has agreed to sponsor the bill for us. But since it has not yet been introduced, we haven't done an actual vote count. But we've had a lot of legislators who have said, yeah, that bill or that law really went way too far, and we understand there need to be some changes. Now, whether they will accept all the changes that we're asking for, we don't know. But I think there's definitely some appetite to make some improvements to this law.
Based on your conversations with members of city councils and city managers, folks who run the cities around the state, Have you seen sort of an overall trend of the impact of this law since it's been in effect and since some members of the legislature have asked the AG to investigate certain ordinances?
Yeah, I think the major effect has been that it's very disruptive and it's very costly because this is another thing that we're talking about. The bill right now, the law requires all of this to be done within 30 days. Well, for the Attorney General to do an investigation, for the city to read that in the report and respond, and then for the Attorney General to issue a decision based on that response, for all that to happen within 30 days is just virtually impossible. And so we would like to at least extend that out to 60 days. But right now what has happened is as soon as one of these complaints is filed, pretty much the city has to drop everything, dispatch all their legal resources and their staff to make sure that what was done is in compliance with state law and go back and pull all the documents related to when something happened. And, you know, it just takes a lot of busy work and a lot of expense to even respond to one of these complaints. And what's ironic is that out of the 8 that have been filed so far, the Attorney General has only found that 2 of them actually are in violation of state law. One of them, the Tucson gun case, was argued at the Supreme Court, and the other one, where he said it was in violation, was the Bisbee plastic bag ban
right.
that affected one store. And so what Bisbee did is they changed a word in their ordinance to say this is a voluntary ban, and that took care of that issue. So really, it's been a lot of spinning of wheels and a lot of expense and a lot of angst that has resulted in very little change.
All right. That's Ken Strobeck, Executive Director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. Ken, thanks as always.
You're welcome, Mark.
From KJZZ's original production, here's the show's Lauren Gilger.
Since President Donald Trump took office last winter, the country has seen a spike in women around the country running for political office. With the success of the Women's March on Washington and now the growth of the Me Too movement, more and more women are getting their names on the ballot. The Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University is tracking this increase, and they're seeing about double the number of potential female candidates running for Congress. There are 79 women around the country, they say, running for governorships this year, 51 of them for open seats. I spoke with Kelly Dittmar, a scholar at the center, about this phenomenon they're tracking and why she thinks it's significant for the future of local and national politics.
This is just a much larger pool of women candidates than we've had in previous cycles. And it's significant because we know that if we get more women running, we'll also have more women winning. So we hope that there are signs here of not only expanding the pool for future electoral cycles, but also seeing some gains in 2018.
And who are these women who are running? Have you broken this down by party, by age, anything like that?
At the House level, almost all of the increase from 2016 is among Democratic women and Democratic women running as challengers to incumbents. And this is indicative of a trend that I think you're seeing more in the broad culture of progressive women really pushing back against the status quo. At the Senate and gubernatorial level, there are more Democrats than there are Republicans. That's consistent with previous cycles, but they're a little more varied in terms of what type of seats they're running for, so not just concentrated among challengers.
So with a lot of challengers, a lot of people challenging incumbents in these races and a lot of progressives running, is this going to be an uphill battle for most of these women?
Yeah, so I think this is important context because it does put a little caution on these numbers. So we definitely want to celebrate the increase in women candidates, but we go into it with eyes wide open that running as a challenger today in the way our districts are drawn is a tough task. And it will be tough for a high percentage of these women to be successful. And remember that we're talking about pre-primary. So first they got to get through their primaries. And then if they're successful, they get to compete against an incumbent, which is a tough thing to do. However, I will say if you look at what happened in Virginia and in Alabama Senate race, if you're talking about Democratic challengers to Republicans, both of those states and the results in those states, I think, provided some hope for Democratic challengers at all levels in 2018.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit about why you think this is happening. I mean, is this all, in your opinion, reaction to Trump's election? I mean, we started with the Women's March last year around this time. Now we have the Me Too movement really taking off. Is all of this, do you think, having a real effect on politics?
I think it's hard to deny that that is a significant motivating force. especially when you look at the partisan differences in who's running. I think among women that there is a sense of urgency in this moment, a sense that, you know, yes, I've been engaged in my community, I've been engaged in activism and advocacy before, but at this point, I need to translate that into being at the table, that if I want to hold the line on the policy issues that I care about, and these aren't just quote-unquote women's issues, these are a host of issues that women really are engaged in and care deeply about, that if they want to hold that line, they're going to have to be at the table, they're going to have to be able to cast votes in legislatures.
Yeah, and I want to talk about this also quickly in context, right? Like, are women anywhere near being equally represented in government, even if all of these women were to be elected?
Yeah, we have a lot of work to do. So women are 25% or less of representatives at all of the levels of office we keep nationwide. So when you average, they're less than 20% in Congress, just at 25% of all state legislators nationwide, and again, just about 25% of statewide elected executive officials.
Wow, yeah.
And just a reminder, they're over 50% of the population, right? So it's going to take a little while to increase those numbers. And I should add one more important contextual piece here. In 2018, we're thrilled at the number of women candidates and the increase in women candidates. But if you look at our list of potential candidates, including men, women are still less than 25% of those candidates. And so they're still underrepresented in the candidate pool, even with this increase. And so this year is a point, I think, for us to celebrate progress. But for us also to see that we've got more work to do and we need to sustain this energy, enthusiasm, and even expand it, including to Republican women as we move forward.
All right. Dr. Kelly Dittmar is with the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers. Dr. Dittmar, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
In light of this rise of women in politics, we wanted to hear from one woman who has some experience in the area. Debbie McCune Davis was first elected to the Arizona State Legislature in 1978 when she was just 27 years old and a mother with two young kids. Since then, she served on and off as both a House and Senate member for more than three decades. She just left her seat last year. I sat down with her recently to talk about her long career as a woman in local politics and how she was received when she first entered the Capitol building all those years ago.
There were people who questioned my ability to manage my responsibilities, but women were really emerging in community action and activity, and I'd been very involved in my community. And I knew there were things that needed to be addressed. And what I noticed about politics as an observer was that if you could set public policy on the right course, you really did create more opportunity in the future. And looking at it from the perspective of a young person and a young person with children, I understood that as a legislator, a policymaker, I could help build good, solid academic and social infrastructure in the state to help families thrive.
So in the beginning, you said it was a pretty good time to be a woman in the state legislature. Did it change over the years? Did it ebb and flow?
Actually, it got better for a while. You know, it takes a little while because it is an institution. So changing anything in an institution takes time.
Yeah.
But I found more women got elected. We were a bigger part of the conversation. We made a difference. We chaired committees. We took on big issues. And for the most part, we had a sense of unity in doing that. But issues of concern to women really changed over time, and pretty soon it became evident that economic issues and all issues became important to women. But I'll give you an example. One of the things that I started out very excited about was a tax credit for childcare. So I rounded up support in the community and introduced my bill. And the chairman of the committee who was hearing the bill agreed to hold a hearing. And so we lined everybody up and we talked about how young families who were now women now in the workforce with kids needed some financial help. I lost that proposal. It did not proceed because the chairman of the committee came from a philosophy that said women belonged in the home and that families that sacrificed to keep the mother at home with her children shouldn't have to subsidize families who didn't make that decision. So that was that became a lesson to me to understand that maybe my idea wasn't quite ready yet. Over time, as more women entered the workforce, frankly, because it's what the economy required, that idea took hold. And in fact, we now have tax credits for that. But when I brought it up, I was a little ahead of the time.
Yeah, I bet. So in terms of the culture at the state legislature, there was just a recent Republic article about sexual harassment in the state legislature. I wonder, what did you see over the years? Is this something that concerned you?
I think it was evident to me at that time that there were some people who maintained traditional views, and they were going to treat women consistent with their belief system. But there were others who were open to working with us as colleagues. And over time, the individuals who worked with us as colleagues got better. You know, we all have that story of the sitting in committee and the chairman sort of grabbing and saying, could you refill my coffee cup for me? And, you know, I had that happen too.
Were there women, especially because in Arizona's history, we've had so many women who have been political leaders, from governors to the executive branch to the state legislature, where we still have more women than most state legislatures around the country. Were there women in your career that you were able to kind of bring up and mentor, or did you have someone like that?
I worked with some really interesting and dynamic women and learned to respect their points of view because we didn't always agree. But one of the early issues I worked on in the legislature was doing some updating of domestic violence laws. Mm-hmm. And I rallied the support of all of the women in the legislature except one. And that individual ended up going on to be Speaker of the House and Governor of the state, Jane D. Hull. And once she was Speaker, she was then open to working with us on everything. And we did get the bill through. Mm-hmm. It did succeed. She was the only one who wasn't willing to sign on as a co-sponsor on the bill at that time because she had her eye on leadership. And it just shows you the fine line that women sometimes have to walk in order to advance in the power structure, and it's always about the power.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So did you feel like as a woman over all of those decades in the state legislature, there were always challenges, more challenges for you than there would have been for a male colleague?
Yes, absolutely. But we learned to work with that, and we learned to build the necessary relationships to get things done.
So you decided not to run the last election and turn over the seat to someone else. But throughout the country right now, we're really seeing a momentum of women running, probably in relationship with the Women's March and the Me Too movement. And in reaction to Donald Trump's presidency, you're seeing a lot of progressive women step up and say, I want to fight this. What advice would you give them?
Well, I understand that feeling because up until Election Day, there was a belief in the community that we would have our first woman president. And there are a lot of folks who are not only disappointed in the outcome, but very frustrated with what they've seen since then. And women are problem solvers, and that's a generalization, but I think there's a lot of truth in it. So going to serve in public office is a way to take on a problem. And so there are a lot of women who are interested. There are a lot of programs that are training women how to run for office and how to be good public servants. And I encourage them to get involved, but I encourage them to get involved in solving the problem, even if it's not running for office. We need to build that bench of folks who can come into office and really sustain change, not just go in and fight a battle and win that battle.
So as we see these women run for office in this new tide, what difference do you think that might make? If there are more women in local government, what kind of changes do you predict we'll see?
Well, there are women in the legislature who come from recent immigrant backgrounds, women who come from education backgrounds, women who come from social work backgrounds, women who come from business, from industry. And what they bring is knowledge and experience. And I think they contribute substantively in a very positive way to the process. So my hope is that we have more of that And if there are men who come into the process with that same attitude about bringing what they know, that's okay too. But for me, a woman who's got good life experience and good skills, who offers herself as a public servant, deserves support.
Debbie McCune Davis was a longtime legislator in Arizona. Today, she serves as the executive director of the Arizona Partnership for Immunization.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. In science news, here's a look at technology making an appearance on stage. Here are the hosts of KJZZ's The Show.
You may have seen images of the late Tupac Shakur from the 2012 Coachella Music Festival. A hologram of Shakur was projected to be on stage. The late Roy Orbison will reportedly be used for an international hologram tour 30 years after he passed away.
And that kind of technology is advancing, which could impact the music industry and possibly how fans view their favorite performers. The show's Steve Goldstein, and not a holographic image of him, the real one, is here with more. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Mark. You know, for good or bad, I'm here in the flesh.
It's good.
So I spoke with Todd Richman, director of the Mixed Reality Lab at USC's Institute for Creative Technologies, to learn about holograms. And I started by asking him whether the holograms have made the concept of live performance mean something very different from what we're used to.
Sure. I think what's interesting is there's a broader question now being posed of what constitutes live music or live performance. But in some ways, you can think about this as an extension of concert films. So for instance, in my younger days, I can remember when groups of us would go to the midnight movie to see The Song Remains the Same, Led Zeppelin, or Jimmy Plays Berkeley. And so this is an example of, you know, somebody who you maybe love the recordings and maybe they died before you got a chance to see them live, or the band is not touring anymore, to experience what their live performance was, but that was on then a flat screen. So in some ways you can think of this as digital allowing the next generation of people to experience a live performance of somebody that is essentially pre-recorded. I think where it starts to get weird is, you know, we understand that a movie or a film is an archival artifact and that we're viewing this and it's on a screen. When you do the hologram, and actually they're not technically holograms, there's a lot of people who will argue about what's a hologram and what's not. Most of these live appearances use what's called the Pepper's Ghost technique, which has been around for about 100 years. But this idea of a sort of three-dimensional floating version of the performer starts to beg some questions about, well, if you can do that, then what other manipulations can you do? And would the performer wanted to have done this gig? And for the ones that, who are alive and still have some control over their image and control over their body of work, they may be able to say yes, no, but for the artists who have passed away, you know, I think you start to ask questions of, for instance, if you had a holographic version of Neil Young, who has come out as being fairly political and usually more towards the liberal side, you know, once he passes away, could a conservative political candidate use his hologram at one of their fundraiser events? Mm.
And now let's get into to some of the technical aspects of this, Todd, because I was surprised when you said their technology they're using has been around for 100 years in some of these cases. So is there incentive to advance this technology, and do you think it'll happen? What would that technology look like?
There absolutely is incentive, and the you can think of the broader field of this around the questions of telepresence. So right now, you know, Skype and video chat is being used by businesses and being used by individuals to try and replace the telephone or add a more immersive experience. And there's been a ton of work in labs. Our labs have worked on a variety of holographic solutions with rotating mirrors and you know, virtual characters that are instantiated on screens and projected onto, you know, dropping water droplets. There's been a lot of work to try and create true holograms, that sort of light coming together to create a light field that creates a representation. Part of that, I think, is driven by art. You know, the canonical example is Princess Leia in Star Wars, that hologram. I think for most of the people nowadays, that kind of is their touch point for what a hologram is. And technologically, you know, all of this stuff is getting better. We're moving from, you know, we moved from telegraph to telephone to radio to television to now augmented and virtual reality. And so holograms and being able to create new characters and recreate existing characters anywhere, anytime, and make them do anything we want, we actually have most of that technology already.
So, I mean, are there deeper pitfalls that actually worry you that are more than just sort of the basic things where, as humans, maybe we overreach a bit?
Sure. It's two jokes for you. One of them is it's always fun until someone loses an eye. and then what's the difference between an entertainer and a musician? An entertainer gets paid. So I think I'm a musician. I've been playing music most of my life since I was 8 years old. I gig. I don't pay the rent off of it because I can't afford to pay the rent given what most musicians make these days. So, you know, as a musician, this is troubling to me. And because this whole idea of what constitutes a live performance and this idea of human musicians having a musical conversation on stage and then extending that conversation to the humans in the audience, that's something that's profoundly analog. It's real time. There's no pause button. So live music has a certain magic to it. As an artist, you have to ask the question of, are we being honest with our fans? And where it really gets weird to me is that some of the fans don't really seem to care. So I think, again, you're going to see a spectrum of what people think constitutes live music. You're going to see a spectrum of what people find acceptable for recreating the dead and selling product and going on tour. But it does force us to reevaluate, what does it mean to be human and what does it mean to create art in the 21st century?
Todd Richmond is director of the Mixed Reality Lab at USC's Institute for Creative Technologies. He spoke with the show's Steve Goldstein.
Thanks for listening to KJZZ. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Fronteras Desk, Mexico saw its deadliest year on record in 2017, with drug violence beginning to spill into some of the country's biggest tourism destinations. That's not an insignificant trend in a country where tourism makes up almost 9% of the gross domestic product. It also marks the first time the U.S. State Department issued travel advisories for beaches like Los Cabos. So we sent KJZZ's Jorge Valencia to Los Cabos to find out whether the news has stopped American travelers from visiting Mexico's resort towns.
Most of the visitors here come from the United States, so along with beautiful sunrises and sunsets, expect to hear covers of your favorite English-speaking bands. It turned out that none of the dozen or so travelers we interviewed here had ever heard of the State Department's advisory.
Could I ask you to read it? This is the actual text.
Exercise, increase caution due to crime.
Due to crime. Criminal activity and violence, including homicide, remain the issue throughout the state.
While most of these homicides appeared to be targeted, criminal organization, assassinations, and turf battles between criminal groups have resulted in violent crime.
Have resulted in violent crimes in areas frequented by U.S. citizens.
Bystanders have been injured or killed in these shooting incidents.
These travelers to the bottom of the Baja California Peninsula come from New York, Texas, and Arizona. Kristen and Matt Olmshake are from Phoenix.
So what do you think?
Well, though it might be true, I've never felt safer in my entire life. We had people coming from all over the United States, New York, Wisconsin, and we felt great.
Wait, did you guys get married or something?
Monday. We got married on Monday.
1/8 of 1/8.
No kidding.
The Olmshakes say 50 guests came to their wedding.
So people didn't shy away from coming, that's for sure.
Drug trafficking in Mexico and consumption in the U.S. has fueled the war here for more than 10 years. And only recently has it arrived on the footsteps of destinations like Los Cabos. Just a month ago, police found 6 bodies hanging off of bridges and the most transited highway for tourists. homicide rate for the state grew tenfold in the last 5 years.
Well, you need to understand that the increase of the violence was because it was a small town. There was no violence for many, many years. We were lucky at that.
Carlos Vasquez is the vice president for sales at the Solmar Group, one of the biggest developers here. His company and other big players say they brought in the government and pooled together $47 million for violence prevention over the last 6 months. That includes the construction of a new military base and almost 200 surveillance cameras across the state.
All of those elements will help, obviously, to deter and to assure that our resort destination will continue to be safe.
Vasquez says his company will invest close to $5 billion over the next 5 years, building luxury housing and a golf course. The local tourism association says the occupancy rate grew slightly to 70% last year. That's a number hotel managers in most places would be happy with.
Good afternoon, Paul Wiener.
Professor Paul Wiener teaches at the School of Hotel and Restaurant Management at Northern Arizona University.
If you take the average leisure traveler, they probably don't even know that the State Department issues travel advisors.
The State Department's most recent advisory for Mexico equates other states in the country to be as dangerous as Iraq or Syria. For all travelers we met in Los Cabos, their perception and reality of safety was the same. That includes Sam Lowther from Mendocino County, California.
This is, we're having an amazing evening. This is the art district of San Jose del Cabo.
Lowther says Los Cabos doesn't seem any more dangerous than, say, Baltimore, Chicago, or where she used to live in Oakland.
Well, and do you guys think, what are the chances you'll come back?
Oh, I think it's very likely we'll come back.
Trying to figure out how to move here.
So for hotel groups here, the challenge is keeping a safe destination as much as a perception of a safe destination for American travelers. But a new survey out this month shows that local Mexican tourists are becoming more wary of destinations, including this one. Jorge Valencia, KJZZ News, reporting from Los Cabos.
And finally, in education news, a new playground is designed to be more accessible. KJZZ's Claire Caulfield put it to the test with a local family.
When Vicky Leonard takes her son Dylan to the park, it's pretty easy to predict where he'll head first.
Oh, look at these swinging is his favorite.
Dylan goes to ASEL, a private school for children with disabilities. But the specialized swing Leonard is buckling Dylan into,
get your pigeon legs out of there,
isn't in his schoolyard. Okay. It's in a public park.
At least you're smiling.
Dylan is 13 and has limited movement due to his cerebral palsy. Additionally, he wears a cochlear implant and is diagnosed with autism, so every playground isn't always a welcoming place.
For me, it was always challenging to go to playgrounds when he was littler, just because of the fact, you can clearly see he's different.
But this new playground at Chaparral Park in Scottsdale aims to be different.
They've got different rope apparatus that you can climb on, different types of slides. I see for sure two different types of slides.
The playground was specifically designed for those with physical disabilities.
And they have ramps for the wheelchairs that will allow for if a child is in a wheelchair or if a parent is in a wheelchair.
And goes the extra mile for those with cognitive or sensory disabilities like autism or Down syndrome.
They've got things with colors and sounds. So there's a couple little wheels over there that you can spin. Different feelings that are really important in a child's development with disabilities and stuff.
This location was chosen because of its proximity to Scottsdale's Adaptive Services Program building. So kids in their after-school program, as well as families from all over the valley, have a new place to play. The City Parks and Recreation Department says this is part of an inclusivity movement happening across the country.
Want to go see if we can climb that walk wall over there? Huh? Aw, I love you. Let's go see what else they have.
So I think having a variety of options at a playground is really great.
That's Laura Montgomery. She's a speech therapist at Dylan's school.
Just sitting here while we've been at the park, I've been watching parents be really involved with children. I've seen senior citizens come up and interact. So there's really a whole community involvement in this park.
She was excited to see the park was accessible while remaining challenging and engaging for kids of all ages and abilities.
It's really important for everyone in our communities to spend time together, for our neurotypical kids to learn how to be great peer buddies, for our friends that are learning skills at just a different rate. And everyone has the opportunity to participate together.
That's just one of the reasons Jesse Bertelson is also excited for the new park. He lives nearby and is pushing his 3-year-old daughter in a bright blue swing.
What's really been cool is how this is an inclusive playground where I don't think I've ever seen anything like this. This is really special, and I think it'll bring a lot of the community outside from behind their iPads and have a lot of fun.
There's kids on monkey bars, kids running up and down the slides, and kids holding their caregiver's hand. All are laughing as they spin on a multicolored merry-go-round. Leonard has always challenged and pushed Dylan to conquer his fears.
Nice. Can you do some more?
And today, she's helping him climb on the jungle gym. When he reaches the top, a big smile breaks out on his face.
And I think that's the way it should be with all families. Don't ever hold your kids back.
The money for this high-tech playground came from the Salt River, Pima Maricopa Indian Community, and Playtime Corp. At around $335,000, it's a steep price tag. But Leonard said it helps build a community, and that's worth it.
If you see a family that's struggling, just reach out. They just want to be included. I would love to see one of these in every 5 square miles of the state, in every state for sure.
Claire Caulfield, KJZZ News, Scottsdale.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.